Thank you for listening to a message from the Manhattan Church of Christ. The following sermon was recorded during our Sunday morning worship service. The notes for this sermon are available on our website at www.manhattanchurch.org/sermon-notes. We hope that this message will be helpful to you and encourage you to explore the Word of God. And now, this week's message.
Good morning, church. Just seen the thing where it was for the youth group to go upstairs. That was usually when I would leave. That was my say. I was waiting for that thing. Like, as soon as it went out, boom, I'm out of here. I'm going upstairs. Yes, good morning. You know, Carl knows anytime you reach out, if he say, you know, want me to read a passage, a sentence, or a couple of letters, I jump up and do it, you know, at any other time. You know, the last week he had just gave me a run through what we're talking about, and you know, the topic of shame. You know, he had let me know that that's what we'd be discussing and what he'd be diving into this Sunday. I was just trying to think about how do I connect with shame personally? Where has it been in my life? How have I seen it? How have I felt it? And I struggled for a little while just trying to come up with something, a story, a moment, a memory. Not that I've never felt shame, but it's an interesting take for me. Personally, I grew up in a household where raised by two parents who had very unique situations in their life. My mom, was blind. She wasn't born that way. But, you know, it was an accident that happened. And, you know, and so with that, I didn't grow up seeing it as a thing. She'd tell me I was embarrassed when we went to school. Like, she felt that I was embarrassed of her. I wasn't embarrassed of her. It's just I was embarrassed of the attention it got because everyone was just, what happened? You know, how does that do? It's just like, yo, I don't know. Like, I don't care what happened. My mom can cook. I read with my mom. I watch TV with my mom. I play games with my mom. She's not defined by that. So I didn't live in that. It wasn't a thing that was always held in front of us or, you know, it's something we did in the house. We had some rules, you know, some respects, but outside of that, that didn't define my mom. You know, my dad, some of you may or may not know his story. I'm not here to tell you because he didn't really share. But there's labels that you can be that can be put on you and that you have to wear. You know, people make you wear it socially throughout your life. And that's not something, you know, he never talked about. It wasn't his strength story. He could tell you a million stories about what made him who the man he was. And that part had never come up because you didn't need to know it. You knew the man you knew. His past wouldn't have changed that. And if it did, it says more about you than it say about him. Right? And that's, you know, and I know one thing about this place here is, no matter what, as a kid who walked in here with do-rags on and a jersey, you know, I never felt judged. I never felt like I was out of place. I knew to take it off when I walked in the door, you know. You know, you don't wear your do-rag inside. It's show the ways, right? I knew this place was safe for me. And you can ask anyone, I was a person that brought people to church. I come up here, 8 to 10, 12 kids from my building, because I let them know, safe here. You're going to see me get on stage, and I might sing, rap, or dance like I did at the church retreat a couple years ago, you know. But my friends never seen that side of me. And, you know, because here at church, I was in a safe space. I went to those retreats, I was in a safe space with people that made me feel good. And a lot of times, shame can also be reflective of who you have around you. You know, the places you walk into. So when you come to church, it should be a place where you're welcomed first. Your decisions, your social ideas and all that we can handle after. Here, you're good. We're going to praise or let's praise. Everything is comes after. That's how I see it. And I'll just say the last thing. One of the things I was shameful for as a kid, I couldn't fight. And the reason why I was shameful, because I was a big guy. Everybody comes see the big Greg, and it's like, oh, you know, but if you challenge, I couldn't throw them things because I didn't grow up fighting, so I didn't know how to do it. And I had a fight in middle school, and didn't go my way. And it shuttled, like, it really shut me down for the middle school year. Like, I didn't get into too many things because I didn't want, like, now, baby, oh, you want to fight, Greg? It's like, nope, we ain't going there. So let's not even do too many arguments, because it was a shame that I felt in that school and those spaces that made me feel like you failed. You're a failure. You're big for nothing. Then I talked to my uncle one time, later, and he told me this one quote. He said, it's better for them to say you can't fight than to say you don't fight. As I grew up, I realized there's still some pressure in that statement to fight. But then I think about, as we closed out Black History Month, there were a lot of people that showed up and it just had to show up and fight. Some of the fighting is not physical fighting, throwing hands, punching and kicking, but it's showing up. Keep coming back. Read this book called Standing at the Scratch Line. And it's at the end of the day, I just want to be able to stand up and go back to the scratch line to fight another fight. And with that, I'll dive into the scripture reading, John 19. I believe that's first. Yeah. 19, 1 through 16. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. But this happened so that works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. After saying this, he spit on the ground and made some mud with the saliva and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him. Wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging and asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? Some claimed that he was, others said, no, he only looks like him, but he himself insisted, I am the man. How are your eyes open? They asked. He replied, the man they called Jesus made me some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and then I could see. Where is this man? They asked. I don't know. He said, they brought to the Pharisees a man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore, the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed, and now I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others asked, how can a sinner perform such signs? So they were divided. I'll move on to John 8, 2 through 11. At the dawn, he appeared again in the temple's courts, where all the people gathered around him. He sat down and teached them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say? They were using this question as a trap in order to have a bias for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No, sir, she said. Neither do I condemn you. Jesus declared, now go on and live your life. Now go and leave your life of sin. Thank you. Shade on.
Thank you all so much. And I can't thank everybody enough for being part of this this time of reflection. Kylie and Catherine, thank you for your teaching and your witness. And Brother Greg, as always, you know, always a thanks. So Holly, they bring such depth and such power with their words. And I just feel glad whenever I get to hear people share. Influential scholar and mystic and the author of the classic work, Jesus and the Disinherited, and Howard Thurman, he once said, "There is something in every one of you that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself. It is the only true God you will ever have. If you cannot hear it, you will spend all of your days of your life on the ends of a puppet string that somebody else pulls." In this quote, Thurman, in my opinion, named something shame tries to silence: the sound of the genuine. Shame is the strangling of that sound. For those who are experiencing poverty, the racialized, the demonized, the scapegoated, the immigrant, the unhoused, empire survives by pulling strings. It strips you where you are before you speak. It tells you what is acceptable, respectable, enjoyable, employable, deportable. And after a while, the puppet forgets that it has a voice. And shame is not guilt. Guilt says you did something wrong. Shame says you are wrong. And when you believe you are wrong at your core, you stop listening inward and start living outward, performing for approval, for safety, for survival. Thurman locates liberation inside. The genuine is not ego. It is the God-breathed center no empire can colonize. If you cannot hear it, you will dance to strings of white supremacy, strings of capitalism, strings of religion, dressed up as holiness. Shame, not being able to hear God's words and dancing to those strings. But if you hear the voice of the genuine, the strings snap. When talking about shame, it's important to be clear on what I'm specifically referring to. This, again, it's my opinion. Shame is the internalized voice of domination that tells you your existence, your very existence, is a problem. It is not merely guilt for wrongdoing. It is the spiritual conditioning that convinces a person that who they are in their very body, their sense of poverty or their race or their doubt, their trauma, their accent, their immigration status, their mental health, their sexuality, their anger, it all says that it is fundamentally defective. It says you are too much. You are not enough. You shouldn't be here. You should go hide. In marginalized communities, and even communities that are considered historically marginalized, shame is often the residue of empire absorbed into the body nervous system. It is what happens when external humiliation becomes part of one's internal messaging about oneself. And shame is a tool of social control. It's a cage built inside the soul. Shame is the engine of binary systems that say pure and impure, saved and damned, worthy, unworthy, citizen, alien. Shame is the silent partner of abuse because it protects the powerful and isolates and humiliates the wounded. Shame does not just wound individuals. It organizes cultures. It creates communities of faith sometimes that look and feel holy, but operate like a hierarchy. It produces people who would rather perform strength than to admit they're in pain or they're experiencing grief. Shame is a domination toward inward. It's important to be clear what shame is not, again, in my opinion. Shame is not a conviction of the spirit. It's not accountability. It's not repentance. It's not humility. It's not remorse. It's not growth. It's not a prophetic call to justice. Again, I'm just for definitions, guilt says I did something wrong, and shame says I am something wrong. Conviction invites transformation. Shame demands concealment. Conviction can move you toward God. Conviction restores relationship. You know, and sometimes in communities and organizations, shame can masquerade as holiness because it feels so serious, you know. It feels reverent, it feels mature. But sometimes, you know, what I call holiness is actually chronic self-rejection, baptized in religious language and spiritual bypassing. Did you recall the story in Genesis when they ate the fruit of the tree and they hid? And then, you know, it says God walking through the garden, And do you recall what the first thing God said? God didn't say, "What did you do?" God said, "Where are you? Where are you?" God was in pursuit, always in pursuit. And I think that's important. The voice of shame says, "Hide, hide." The voice of God says, "Come out. Come on out." Shame says your scars, those challenges, those horrors, they disqualify you. Those scars disqualify you. Those wounds disqualify you. But Jesus says, "Put your hand here. Feel my scars. Feel the wounds." Shame humiliates. Empire thrives on humiliation, where people who are poor and broke are shamed for being poor and broke, and shamed for not being able to hide their suffering better. Where people who are immigrants are shamed for surviving and breathing. Where our gay and trans loved ones are shamed for having the audacity to say, "I am a human being and I belong here." Where people of color are shamed for reminding people of racism. And you know what's kind of sad sometimes? And if you absorb enough of that humiliation and shame, if you do it long enough, you don't need empire, racism, homophobia, anti-poor, and Islamophobia. You don't need any of those things to police or shame you anymore, because you'll begin doing it yourself easily. And that's literally a shame. Again, it's worth repeating. Shame is not, "I did wrong." Shame says, "I am wrong." It's oppression under Pharaoh without the whips. It's the empire of Rome without the brutal soldiers. It's the enslavement of Africans without the chains. Jesus says in Luke 4, he stands up and announces the good news to the poor. "Release the captives, sight to the blind." He didn't say, "I'm going to bring in more humiliation." He says, "No more hiding. Come out." And if our theology makes the already burdened feel heavier, then that's not the gospel story. It's shame-induced control. And it's important for me, especially at this time, to name shame. Because if you don't name it, you kind of normalize it. And what you normalize, you baptize. But I don't want to baptize shame. Sometimes shame-based faith can fuel a cycle of fear. A shame-based faith says, you are so deprived. Oh, God is always angry at you. You're doing it all wrong. You deserve to burn in hell. And if you step out of line just once, you're going to get punished by God. In that scenario, what's the organizing principle? It's fear. Fear reinforces the shame. And sometimes I'll just say this, in this culture and society where people are drowning in humiliation and shame, and racial shame, spiritual shame, sexual shame, class shame, shame in families, shame in church communities, shame in political spaces, political policies, when people feel as though they are overcome with shame from every possible angle, sometimes they begin to admire and idolize those who appear immune from shame, or the shameless. Those who appear to be free of concerns of things like remorse and accountability, restraint or forgiveness. Those who shamelessness is sometimes considered by some a superpower. Political leaders, wealthy oligarchs who traffic in cruelty and harm, they know. Sometimes, you know, it's easy to admire people like that. And they can be very attractive to people who feel burdened and beat down by feeling like they never can measure up, always imperfect. And they can be very confusing sometimes. Nuance sometimes is just not clear enough. It's not strong enough. And sometimes things that are shame-based, the binaries, heaven, hell, right, wrong, misfortune, sin, and, you know, sometimes those things can be clear in a time of chaos. In John, the disciples see a man born blind and immediately reach for a binary, I think, to religiously shame him. Who sinned? Who sinned? Him or his parents? See, now that's how shame is thought. It demands a culprit. It refuses the mystery. It refuses nuance. It demands certainty. It kind of baptizes suffering and says it's always somebody's fault. What did they do to deserve this? They had to do something. And to be clear, binary can be pretty tidy. It's comfortable. It's easy. Someone is righteous. Someone is sinful. Someone is good. Someone is bad. Someone is cursed. Someone is blessed. Someone belongs. Someone doesn't. Someone deserves the horrible life situation they got. And some who are blessed, they deserve blessing. Shame kind of feeds on that kind of clarity. It keeps systems clean and the consciousness numb. If his blindness is punishment, then our comfort is proof of virtue. And, you know, in ancient imagination, in ancient cultures, you know, like the story in Job, you know, the book of Job, with this, you know, suffering was often filtered through the brutal equation. Good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And Job's friends, they clung to this theology like a weapon. If you are blessed, then you must be righteous. If you are broken, if you are harmed, if you are imperfect, then you must have sinned. It's clean, it's tidy, it's predictable, but it's cruel. This formula does, it does more than just diagnose suffering. It manufactures shame. It tells the grieving mother, the sick body, the unemployed father, the incarcerated son, that it's all your fault. Shame becomes spiritualized. Pain becomes proof of moral failure. And God becomes an accountant instead of a companion in the ashes. But Jesus refuses the binary. He does not diagnose the blame. He actually disrupts it. What did he say? Neither of them sinned. With one sentence, he collapses the shame economy. And he expresses and exposes how addicted one can become sometimes to moral cause and effect. When Jesus touches the man who was born blind, What happens there? He didn't give a theological discourse or didn't do a Bible study, didn't really debate. He just had mud, his hands, and presence. And he said, neither this man or his parents sinned. This was done so that the work of God may be displayed in his life. Jesus refuses the shame equation. And I just wonder, what if we did that? What if we stopped scanning people's pain for fault and started looking for God's glory? You know, not glory for spectacle, but as a sacred presence breaking through. What if someone, you know, who's going through a challenge, you know, experiencing unhousedness and experiencing poverty or experiencing anxiety, someone who had a teenager who was struggling with mental health, someone in the grips of poverty? What if we just looked at people as possible living altars of God breaking through? And just showing, here's an opportunity for God to break through, as opposed to, oh my God, what a loser. When Jesus healed the man, the Pharisees and some others, they actually couldn't rejoice. Their system felt threatened. If God works outside of our categories, then maybe our categories are nothing more than idols. Maybe sometimes we are engaged in a form of idol worship. I know sometimes I am. It's a tough line to walk sometimes. Shame always narrows the story. It says, blind equals cursed sin. Poor equals lazy. Incarceration equals irredeemable. Immigrant and black bodies equal threat. Gay and trans bodies equal fear. Shame-based binary thinking keeps us from seeing the image bearers of God. Think about it. Whenever you looked at something and saw threat, fear, someone coming to get your stuff, coming to get you, what if you just saw an opportunity for God to be displayed in their life? Would that change behavior a little bit? Maybe a little bit? A little? Sometimes the uncomfortable truth is, you know, I have times in my life, I've preferred the binary sometimes, and maybe we all have. It gave me control. It kept me sometimes feeling superior, because I'm pretty insecure, and I need to feel superior about some things, and if I can feel superior over you sometimes when I'm feeling anxiety, then I'll take it. Sometimes that superiority, it can let us explain suffering away, as opposed to just sort of entering in the suffering with our fellow human being. John 9 is not just about sight. It's about exposure. Our exposure, my exposure. The real blindness in the text to me is not the man born blind. It's the ones who cannot imagine a world beyond shame. Imagine a world beyond shame, where shame is not the governing principle all the time, that always says you are wrong, you did something wrong, you are no good, you're worthless. Imagine a world beyond that. That's what Jesus said. Neither his parents nor he sinned. This was done so what? So the glory of God can be seen in his life. Similar with John 8. John 8, where shame is weaponized in public. You know the story. It's a familiar story. The woman is dragged into the temple courts at dawn. She's not invited, dragged, exposed, and used. The folk there, the religious folk there, don't really care about holiness. They care about leverage. She's a prop. A prop in a theological trap. Her body becomes a courtroom. Her shortcoming becomes public spectacle, a tool for humiliation. See, that's how shame works. It's rarely about restoration. It's always about control. Notice the binary. Guilty or innocent. Stone or absolved. Lawful or lawless. The men standing safely on the righteous side of the line, they drew the line. The woman stands alone on the other. Shame always isolates people. It isolates its targets. Jesus does something disruptive. He stoops, he writes in the dirt. He refuses to perform outrage. He refuses to play prosecutor. And then he says, anyone who was out of sin, let them throw the first stone. Then the binary collapses. Suddenly, everyone is implicated. The accusers walk away, and shame, it lost its mob. It's lost its likes, its click likes. Then Jesus speaks to the woman, not as a case study, not as a scandal, but as a human being. Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Shame humiliates. Grace refuses humiliation. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Light here is not exposure for execution. It's exposure to freedom. You know what kind of reminds me of shame? Is you know the son of the prodigal son story, the one in Luke 15. It's not the actual prodigal son, the one who's give me my money, Dad. I'm out of here. But it's the older brother. You know, I actually identify more with the older brother. Maybe that tried to do the right thing. His brother never left home. Yet he's just as lost as his brother. The older brother, his obedience is transactional. His faith is fueled by comparison. Shame has taught him that love must be earned. Proximity equals superiority. And he really just couldn't rejoice because to him, grace felt like theft. You ever felt that? I have. I have a lot. The father's generosity exposes his hidden wound. All these years, I've slaved for you. Shame turns servants and brothers into rivals, huh? The elder brother reveals an uncomfortable truth. Sometimes the one who stays is sometimes farther away from the father's heart than the one who left. The elder brother is not simply jealous. He's, like me many times, addicted to moral superiority. He has built an identity on being the good one, the reliable one, the one who never embarrassed the family, never embarrassed the church, never embarrassed the school, never embarrassed the firm, never embarrassed the political party. His obedience is immaculate, but it's also loveless. Shame has trained him to believe that belonging must be deserved. So grace kind of feels offensive. Grace? They don't deserve it. I worked hard. I deserve it. Sound familiar these days? The father celebration unmasks him. He doesn't want intimacy. He wants wages. Wages. I've been slaving for you. The word exposes everything. Shame has convinced him that sonship is employment. And it's kind of sad that he probably would rather his brother stay lost than lose his advantage. His righteousness depends on someone else's failure. You ever felt that? Where your sense of your faith narrative depends on how much you, someone else's, is beneath you. I felt that. Actually, I have to fight against that all the time. The brother couldn't enter the party because Seamus taught him that joy must be rationed. And I just, you know, right now is a tough time. You know, we're a nation going to be in war, a nation scapegoating. The nation says people are deserving, someone can vote. They did well, let's show me, give me your ID, make sure they. And people are really, unfortunately, being torn apart in faith communities, homes. But it's always important to remember what Jesus said in both of those texts. First, in the first one, who sinned is him or his parents, that he was born this way. And Jesus says, neither. And I want you to take that word neither into yourself. Neither. And also in the second, neither do I condemn you. Neither do I condemn you. That word neither. And I hope that for those who must have an other, who must have a villain, I hope you remember those words, the two neithers. Shall we stand for the benediction? Amen. If possible, unashamed. As we go from this place, let us remember this. Focus on this. The voice that has told us you are not enough, that you should have known better, you'll never change. That voice was never God. In the garden, when humanity hid in fear and nakedness, God did not shout. God just asked, where are you? Not to expose, but to restore. In the streets of empire, where Rome used crosses to humiliate and erase, Jesus endured the machinery of shame and despised it. The resurrection is God's public refusal to agree with our humiliation, our sense of shame. So, if possible, hear this clearly. You are not your worst decision. You are not your trauma. You are not your addiction. You are not your record. You are not what they called you in middle school. You are not the worst that you can think of. Even though shame says hide, you feel like hiding, God says come out. Shame says perform. Do it. Do the thing. Grace says, hey, just belong. The Father runs toward you before you finish your speech. Oh, I'm sorry, I did it wrong again. The Father says, hey, I don't want to hear all that. You're here. When the world has tried to brand you as disposable, defective, and dangerous, the Spirit brands you beloved. So as you walk out unhidden, walk out uncovered, walk out unafraid as best you can. When shame tries to follow you home, remind shame that the tomb is empty. And I will not carry around what Christ already buried. As we go out, go home, or go upstairs, we go in dignity, go in God's grace. Go as those who refuse to be humiliated. And in the name of the one who comes looking for you while you're still hiding, go in peace.